Seneca 21, AD 57, The Lull Before the Storm. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. It's now AD 57. Agrippina is, to all intents and purposes, a spent political force. She has very little influence or power left with which to make any further major power plays. Seneca, along with his political ally Burrus, commander of the Praetorian Guard, are fighting a never-ending skirmish with Nero, trying to head him off at the pass of cynical excess and abuse of his position as emperor of the entire Roman world. No sooner do they put out one fire than another blazes up. They are fighting a losing battle. The ancient commentators actually have very little to report about the year AD 57. They appear to glide over it, almost as if eager to get to the mayhem and controversy that erupted in the years immediately following. In AD 57 itself, though, Nero saw to it that he was appointed consul for the second time. And there's no doubt whatsoever that he was up to his old tricks of baiting and tormenting the upper echelons of Roman society with his impetuous carryings on. Vindictive and self-serving he may have been, but nobody could deny the young man had a flair for the outrageously spectacular. Cassius Dio relates one incident in which Nero, while staging a spectacle in one of Rome's theatres, suddenly had the place filled with seawater, complete with fish and sea monsters, on which he staged a naval battle between rival fleets representing Athenians and Persians. With the naval battle over, the theatre was just as quickly drained, the ground dried, and then contests between both individual combatants and larger groups of armed men took place. And it's probably worth pointing out here that at this stage of his principate, Nero was only really getting up the noses of Rome's elite, the patrician classes. It was against them that he seemed chiefly to be directing his cruel humour and malign trickery. Even the next social rank down, the equites or knightly class, didn't seem to attract as much spiteful animosity as the families at the top of Rome's social pile. So, just like in the early years of the reign of one of his recent predecessors, Caligula, it's highly likely that Nero, in AD 57, was still the darling of the Roman mob and plebs. All they saw was a charismatic young emperor who lavished money on stunning arena spectacles, splendid chariot races, and superb theatrical performances, at all of which they had the opportunity of getting a seat. No, the plebs would only start to become disgruntled when an emperor did something that directly affected their own day-to-day existence. Like something like create a grain shortage because the state treasury had been emptied to finance some particularly selfish and wasteful whim. Just as Caligula had done when, in AD 39, he caused starving mobs in Rome to riot because, according to Seneca, he'd decided to spend massive amounts building a bridge of boats across the bay between Baiae and Puteoli, that's modern-day Baiae to Puteoli, to emulate the feat of Xerxes crossing the Hellespont during the Greco-Persian Wars. Now that was the type of carry-on that was going to upset the plebs, but Nero, as yet, hadn't gone down that particular road. So, apart from trying, and for the most part failing, to do his best to keep a lid on Nero's worsening behaviour, what else was Lucius Annaeus Seneca up to in AD 57, the year before everything would start to go horribly wrong for him? Well, for one thing, he seems to have been keeping a close eye on the events unfolding in the newish province of Britannia. The Roman legions had, by AD 57, progressed well beyond a line drawn between the river Humber and the Severn estuary. Nero had appointed a new governor to the province, one Quintus Veranius, early in the year with the remit of widening Roman control in the island. Viranius proceeded to mop up the southern part of what is modern-day Wales before his death and replacement later in the same year by Gaius Suetonius Paulinus. There was always money to be made and wealth to be acquired as Roman influence grew in a fledgling province. And later accusations levied against Seneca, which I'll deal with when we get to them, infer that he was using some of the new wealth lavished upon him as the emperor's closest advisor to invest in certain high-profile British interests. And of course, Seneca was writing. He was probably working even then on parts of his encyclopedic Naturales Quaestiones, or Natural Questions. The work, in seven books, the original order of which is debated, is a mammoth hodgepodge of natural science and standard philosophy, to the extent that the ancients, especially the Stoics, distinguish between the two. It deals with everything, ranging from the lasciviously depraved behaviour of an obscenely rich Roman during the reign of Augustus, to what Seneca describes as a pitched battle between crocodiles and dolphins in the Nile Delta, something that was reported by a man who took up the prefecture of Egypt in AD 55. I'll deal with the Naturales Quaestiones, one of Seneca's magna opera, in greater detail at a later point in this podcast series. But just for now, let's take a quick look at that part in the work, it's actually book four, which deals with Egypt and the Nile, and how reading between the lines of what came from Seneca's stylus can help shed some light on the earlier life of this most enigmatic of men. I talked in the earlier podcast on the Consolatio ad Helviam Matrem, a consolation to my mother Helvia, written during the later years of Seneca's exile on Corsica, about how, contrary to the ink spilled on the subject by many, many historians and academics, there is actually zero definitive evidence that Seneca spent part of his earlier life in Egypt. And the book on the Nile and the Natural Questions certainly bears that out. Because despite citing many other authors and authorities, Greek as well as Roman, and reporting many anecdotes, such as the marine creature battle in the Nile Delta, not once does Seneca comment or report in the first person. When I was there, I did this, I did that, I saw this, I witnessed that type of thing. And all citations come from others. Everything, and I mean everything, is neutrally relayed. And if you've been following this podcast series this far, you'll have worked out by now that if there was one thing Lucius Annaeus Seneca really, really liked to do, it was to broadcast his own learning and expertise. So had Seneca spent any of his youth in Egypt, then book four of the Natural Questions is where I would have expected to find some reference to that time. There is none. So this is yet another reason why I personally do not think that Seneca ever set foot in the place. Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering about the outcome of the battle between the dolphins and the crocodiles, the dolphins won. Apparently, their greater manoeuvrability allowed them to dive beneath their enemies and slice open the crocodile's soft and vulnerable underbellies with their tough, sharp dorsal fins. Anyway, back to AD 57, and an act was passed by the Senate whereby any slave or even any freedman living under the roof of a master who had been murdered had to be punished. And I'm bringing up that particular ruling here because I often wonder on which side of the vote Seneca came down. The reason for my musing is that Seneca seemed to have quite strong views on how slaves should be treated. Although he wouldn't put stylus to scroll on the subject until he authored his famous Epistolae Morales ad Lucilium, commonly known as the Moral Letters, five or so years after the Act was passed in the Senate, it's worth bringing it up here because it gives us a deeper insight into what may have made the man tick. In one of those later letters, Epistle 47, Seneca starts off by complimenting his addressee, Lucilius, for living on what he terms familiaritas, or friendly terms, with his slaves. Such an attitude, says Seneca, befits his friend's sensible and well-educated nature. They are slaves, Seneca quotes other less enlightened Romans in an imagined conversation as saying, servi sunt. No, replies Seneca, they are people. Servi sunt, insist the others. No, counters Seneca, they are contubernales, they are comrades. Slaves, insist the others. Humble friends, retorts Seneca. Slaves, maintain the others. No, replies Seneca, getting in the final word in the exchange. Because if you accept that fortune has an equal say over everyone, he says, then we are all slaves together. We are all conservi. The letter then goes on to catalogue a litany of the obscene excess to which Seneca's contemporary Romans would go to show off their wealth by having slaves perform humiliating tasks for visitors. Forced to remain mute and attentive while the guests gorged and disported, some slaves had to remain crouched under the tables to scoop up the vomit and dropped food and drink, while others, whose job it was to serve wine, were kept plucked and beardless and dressed as women to be fondled, and much worse, by master and guests alike. It wasn't all bad news for Roman slaves, though. Some, through long and faithful service, earned their freedom. Seneca tells us of one such, Callistus, who, having been freed, made such a success of himself that he took his revenge on one of his former masters by cutting him from the dinner invite list. Such tricks does destiny play on us, slave and patrician alike, warns Seneca. Be careful how you treat people, because you don't know when the axe of fortuna will fall on you, however exalted you may currently be. Seneca goes on to advise that Romans should associate with their slaves on friendly terms. Value people for their character, not their jobs, he says, because friends can be found among slaves in the home as well as in the senate house or at the forum. Saepe bona materia cessat sine artifice, he tells Lucilius. Good material is often left untouched for want of an artist. In other words, don't judge a book by its cover. Look beyond the slave at the person beneath, because you could easily miss out on something good. And he finishes off by saying that all men are slaves to something. We all have some kind of master or mistress. Seneca says that it all boils down to mutual respect between master and slave, but respect means love, and love and fear cannot sit at the same table. And finally, Seneca compliments Lucilius for a strict punishment to a verbal lashing when his slaves deserved it. Only dumb animals, he writes, need the goad. So the question is this all genuine? Did Seneca really buck the trend of what he implies was the normal dismissive, domineering, often violent attitude of his contemporary Romans toward their slaves? Or was it all just another load of old blarney designed to promote his philosophical erudition? Now that's a tricky question. So let's take a quick look at another of Seneca's moral letters to Lucilius, this time the famous Epistle 7, and let's see if that one helps us build a more complete picture of the man. Because it wasn't just the treatment of slaves that got Seneca all hot under the collar. I'll mention Epistle 7 here, even though Seneca wouldn't write it for a few years yet, because earlier in this podcast, I mentioned the extravagance that was typically lavished on the arena spectacle extravaganzas. In this letter, or Epistle number 7, Seneca lets us know in no uncertain terms what a complete waste of time and money these things were, how he hated going to them, and how he saw them as venues that brought the behaviour of a collective crowd down to its lowest, most bloodthirsty and moronic common denominator. Seneca describes the games as places where people absorb vice in the guise of pleasure. It steals into you, he says, and you end up going home greedier, more ambitious, lewder, crueler even, and more inhuman. He writes about attending a midday exhibition, expecting it to be a bit more relaxing than the more intense shows of the morning and later in the day and evening. But he was sorely disappointed because the lunch interval featured condemned criminals driven into the arena to fight to the death for the enjoyment of those who'd bothered to stay behind to watch. There was no finesse here, no artful martial skill to admire between trained combatants. Nobody was given defensive armour to wear. They had no helmet, no shield. And if one opponent was killed, then the next was sent in to take his place. And so on and on and on. There was no escape. These fights to the death between desperate men, says Seneca, were mera homicidia, murder, pure and simple. Apparently, though, the crowds seemed to enjoy watching this type of slaughter more than the alternative which took place earlier in the day when the criminals were simply thrown to starved wild lions and bears to be ripped apart and eaten. At noon, says Seneca, the criminals were thrown to the spectators instead. There's more in the letter in which Seneca likens the mob to a howling wild beast, baying for blood, but overall his personal distaste for the whole thing comes through very, very clearly. So again, we're left with the same dilemma. Was Epistle 7 a true and genuine insight into the man? Or was it just more intellectual grandstanding from the morally superior high ground, Seneca extracting a philosophical lesson from a situation and venue that would have been immediately identifiable to his Roman audience? And this is the major problem when attempting to understand Seneca, in trying to work out what he was in essence. He's been called many things, both good and bad. And maybe he was many things. A man who wore a literary mask whenever he was responding to shifting situations, taking the opportunity to ride prevailing opinion through his stylus. On the other hand, perhaps he was genuinely interested in the greater good of humanity's collective soul, but had come up against something he was too weak, or at least not strong enough, to influence in the form of a wayward Nero. And then again, perhaps he was simply a complete and massive hypocrite, pumped up by his own rhetoric and with his face in the trough of his own self-perceived importance to the world. That's a dilemma we'll revisit in later podcasts. For now, though, let's leave the relatively placid waters of AD 57 behind. It was truly the lull before the storm. In AD 58, it all changed for the worse, and all hell broke loose. I hope to see you in the next installment. Please join me there.